My word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of what these days, I suppose, could be called competitive data retrieval between our teams of genuine non-electronic brains, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. The first data bank we're going to inspect is, as usual, vocabulary. Frank, what's the meaning of caprification? C-A-P-R-I-F-I-C-A-T-I-O-N.
The lady in the audience nodding. caprification is what Gracie Fields underwent when she had to leave England.
Two marks for inventiveness. Reason. Two marks. If you've got two marks
for
inventiveness. You can get an extra mark for the meaning.
Don't want an extra mark. I'm not greedy.
I'm glad you're not. It's impossible to give you. Anybody know what it is on the?
Is it not? No copra. I think capri. No.
It's not to do with goats, is it?
Capricorn? No. No. Let me. I must tell you because it's a very interesting process. It's the artificial ripening of figs by encouraging wild fig gall insects to puncture them.
Oh.
So you ripen the fig.
Well, you must point out the lady who was nodding.
I thought at your Thameside rural community you'd be doing it all the time.
Yeah.
Antonia, the meaning of flocculent, F-L-O-C-C-U-L-E-N-T.
Well, it must be something to do with sheep and flocks, that sort of thing.
Well, it's to do, in a strange way, with sheep, but not with the flocks.
Well, wool, then, is it?
Yes, it is to do.
Wool, she said with more confidence. It's to do with wool.
Well, to do with wool, or give us an adjective.
Well, woolly is what
well
I
done.
Say.
Two marks for woolly, because it is one of the definitions in the dictionary, but it's woolly or exhibiting tufts of wool, and is used in chemistry when liquids turn, have sort of cloudy bits in them, like tufts of wool, I suppose. Anyway, two marks for Antonio. Dilys, the meaning of troglodyte, T-R-O-G-L-O-D-Y-T-E.
It means living underground or in a hole or something. Living in a cave.
Yes, that's too much. Too much. Dennis, I think you ought to listen very carefully now because your word, the thought of actually having to pronounce it has meant I've spent an abstemious 24 hours. are you ready?
Yeah.
It's... I'll start again. Flockinousy nihili pilification. And if you'd like to write it down, you'd better fill up your pen first.
Couldn't say it again a bit faster, could you?
No. Flockinousy nihili pilification.
Flockinousy.
I gave you the alternative pronunciation that time.
Yeah, I've actually seen it. It's in all books about what's called, I think it's called playful linguistics. This is always down as a word that is longer than anti-disestablishmentarianism, isn't it?
And I haven't measured them, actually, but it
and
looks
it's
longer.
Nihili comes into it and another part of the word, and it's something to do with trivialities and nothings and things which aren't really important. And
well, this program.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The sort of...
Say no more. Say
yes, all
no
right,
more.
Yeah.
You'd get two marks. He got it.
Yeah.
The dictionary says the action or habit of estimating as worthless. and it is actually made up of lots of Latin words, all signifying at little or at nothing. Well, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. And Frank's is, "Down among the sheltering palms," which is sung by Al Jolson, I think. And Dennis, "Off we go into the wild blue yonder," which used to finish nearly every film I saw at the Gaumont Doncaster in the 1940s. As the American Army or American Air Force did exactly that. So off we go into the wild blue yonder. But we'll come to those later. First, a round of Victoriana. In fact, a round of Victorian vernacular. Who or what in Victorian times was vulgarly known as follows? Frank, a choker, a spouter, a cushion thumper, or an earwig?
They all mean the same thing.
They all mean the same thing, and they were...
The spouter was a talker. There were spouting clubs of people who stood up and debated. And a cushion thumper was a preacher, because they always used to preach leaning on a cushion. As they thumped it, the clouds of dust traditionally arose. So presumably, they're all... if they're all speakers... And one of them is a preacher. They're all preachers.
Yes, four parsons. 2 marks to Frank. Antonia, a canary, a goldfinch, a yellow boy, or a thick'un? Or as we say in Weybridge, a thick'un.
Thick'un. Is it... Something like a sovereign, something...
It's something so like a sovereign, it is a sovereign, and you win 2 marks. Well done. Dillis. Kisky, K-I-S-K-Y, Coxy-Loxy, Stiffo, or All Mops and Brooms? Victorian vernacular for what?
Tipsy whipsy, I should think.
I think that's much better. 2 marks to Deliz.
Hi, old guy.
But our word setter, Peter Moore, rather, I thought, in Victorian style, puts an inebriate. But why all mops and brooms, Dennis Frank? What's that, the rhyming slang?
I don't even know. Why kisky? All mops and brooms probably means in a cupboard. They're all over the place.
Yeah. Dennis, your lot of Victorian vernacular. A bell rope, a bow catcher, B-E-A-U catcher, as opposed to a Frank Muir collar catcher, and a cobbler's knot.
Is it ways of tying your shoe, of tying your shoelaces?
Bell rope, a bow catcher.
I tell you what, it could be. It could be forms of birth control.
That's 2 marks for invention again. The bonus mark now for the actual
bell rope.
I think it's
from a hat. Antonia's doing a very useful mime.
Hat, she was doing the mime of.
Yes, well
she
was a bit high.
On top of her head.
Yes, come down from the hat. But she's come down from the hat. And she's actually...
To curls, hair.
You're getting very close to it. It's a type of...
Wig?
No.
You have to comb your hair afterwards.
I think I'm going to have to tell you. No? We'll give you your 2 marks for invention, but the real answer is a type of hairdo.
Oh.
Hairdo is not particularly Victorian. Anyway, 2 marks to Dennis.
It's lovely to go in and say, could I have a shampoo and a bell rope?
Yes, you want to watch it in some quarters. Next, a round of verbal transplants, words of one language which have become adopted into another in a slightly mangled form. Now, Frank, the French word for a fanlight over a door is, it's V-A-S-I-S-T-A-S. It's said to result from a visit by German tourists to France in the 19th century. So, can you account for why this got...
Was ist das?
Thus is das.
Exactly, you've got there. That's why I didn't pronounce it in the first place. Two marks of Tavrek.
Have we got bistro in the round?
No, we haven't got bistro.
Because bistro was Russian for these. Quick, when the Russians were in Paris. Mm. Mm.
Bistro.
So they called quick food places bistro. Mm.
As
bonus mark, I would have thought.
Yes, I hope we give you a bonus mark. So, yes, perhaps we ought to explain that it was the fanlights were a novelty to the Germans when they visited. Why they should be, but anyway, they were, so they gave them their name. Antonia, it has been suggested that the Dutch phrase, ich niet weet, and notice the southern Holland pronunciation, meaning I don't know, has abbreviated and transformed become an English noun of a derogatory nature.
Well, your pronunciation was so perfect that it must have been nitwit.
Yes, it was. Two marks, I tell you. Dillis, the French expression quelque chose, meaning something, particularly something trivial, has given rise to an English word synonymous in meaning. Oh. What is that word? And your friend...
Kickshaw. Kickshaw.
Well done.
Kickshaw.
Two marks. Your friend was leaping to your assistance and you didn't need it. Dennis, the Russian word for a railway station, which is V-O-K-S-A-L, with your Russian accent, you'll get that right, derives from a visit by 19th century Russian railway engineers to an English railway station in South London.
Where presumably they saw a certain make of car.
Yes.
Would it be Vauxhall?
It is. The visit was to Vauxhall Station, whose layout so impressed the Russians that they took the word home with them, which, if anybody goes through Vauxhall Station in the mornings, knows was much more sensible than taking the station. Anyway, two marks all round.
It could have been a straight swap with Waterloo, couldn't it, actually?
And, I mean, if our word setter, Peter Moore, hasn't been having us on, I think he deserves two marks.
We'll
put him in the post, too, Peter. They're very clever round, and very clever people answer them. Mm-hmm. Now, a quick round of assorted Americana. By what name are the following Americanisms more generally known on this side of the Atlantic?
Places.
That's minus one to Frank. Good guess. But a realtor.
Oh, yeah.
R-E-A-L-T-O-R.
Well, estates in England are managed and bought and sold by estate agents, and it's called real estate in the States. And therefore they're called realtors or realtors.
You get your two marks. Antonia, what do Americans refer to when they refer to a transom? T-R-A-N-S-O-M.
Yes, the bus is dust.
The bus is dust.
My partner and friend has come to my aid and he says it's a vasistas.
I don't know. What do we call
And could
it?
You tell us what a vasistas is?
I will tell you what a transom is. It's the fanlight over the door.
Two marks to Antonia. And two marks to Antonia for vasistas, which is also, of course, a fanlight. Dillis, Americans refer to a vest when Frank would refer to his...
It's a
waistcoat. Waistcoat. Well done. Two marks. Two marks. And Dennis, a very easy one for you for a change. Americans refer to a casket.
Coffin. Coffin, yeah. must be awfully confusing for them, because I remember they used to advertise caskets of chocolate for Christmas.
Well, now we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. And Frank's quotation is, down among the sheltering palms.
I'm really addressing myself to the millionaires amongst the listeners, of which there must be countless, if any. I mean, because I need some money. It isn't quite like that, because I'm going to give you a proposition, make you an offer, which is irrefusable. I think, you see, because I think my wife and I are going to have the most enjoyable Christmas we've ever had. We're really looking forward for the first time to December the 25th this year. Because our Christmas is always, something's always gone wrong. I remember when we were first married, and my wife was in bed, laid up, and I volunteered to do the Christmas dinner, and I worked from a cookery book, you know, and I went and selected the turkey. We've got to get the plump thighs and things, and the BBI. And all went well until the stuffing. Now, what the cookery book didn't say was that the turkey should be dead. And the look of reproach on that bird's face will haunt me. Nothing's been quite satisfactory at home, and it's always been said that the heating usually breaks down. I mean, last year, where we were, it was cold enough to freeze the baubles off the Christmas tree. And we had this wonderful invitation to spend Christmas in Australia. And a chap in the village, Ronnie Hayes, emigrated to Perth, in the Western District, Perth. And apparently it's 95 there, at 7 at the Christmas evening. And they have dinner there in bikinis, with turkey and everything, you know. And it's all been laid on for us. And I have all his pommy friends, a congregation of other English expatriates. It's a kind of heaven, you see, except for the price of the ticket. Because if you ever asked an airline for the price of a ticket, they charge like a wounded buffalo. So I need money, a lot of money, rather quickly. And I had this concept of advertising myself that I would be able to judge the sex of a person's child. Just send me a pound and a lock of hair, and I will tell you the sex of your baby. Money back if I'm wrong. So I reckoned that I'd get 50% of everything that was sent in. But nobody sent anything in, and I put a postcard, beautifully written postcard, and I pinned it up in our village hall, but nobody responded. And the Darby and Joan go there every Monday. Then at night, this inspiration came to me. I know how I can do millionaires a lot of good, and I can get this money for our Christmas in the heat of Perth. And that is, will you listen carefully, millionaires? And what you do is this. You present yourself at Broadcasting House at the busiest part of the morning, and you stand up there and you say very loudly, Frank Muir is a goat-faced old has-been, and it's time he was put out to grass. Now, hang on a minute. Now, a judge might think that's fair comment. what you have to say, stand up and shout, Frank Muir is a goat-faced old has-been, and I know he accepts money from a foreign power for spreading woe and despair through the Western world. Now, my solicitor will be present, and amidst the gasps from the people in the foyer of Broadcasting House, he will take written statements confirming what you said. He will then issue you with a High Court writ for slandering me for £2 million. Now, that will then go before a counsel, for counsel's opinion, who will say, it's an open and shut case, old boy. They always say that. But in this case, it'll be true. It'll then go to a judge, and we're given a hearing date. But just before the hearing date, you settle out of court for £1 million. You then pay me the £1 million, free of tax. I then deduct my fare to Australia and pass the rest on to your children, who then get all your money entirely free from capital transfer tax. For millionaires, please write in, just apply. I think it's a foolproof scheme. And as soon as I accept the first one and we get this thing through, your children will have your money and you don't have to go to Jersey and kill yourself on gin at 18p a bottle. The money will go straight to them free of tax. And my wife and I, 25th of December next, will be there in Perth, where we'll, as Al Johnson said, dine among the sweltering ponds.
Thank you, Frank, for that appeal that no millionaire can refuse. Dennis, let's see how you get on with Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder.
Well, yeah, that's the line that I'll probably use as one of my chapter headings in a book of advice that I'm currently writing for parents entitled Travelling with Young Children on 5 Aspirins a Day. Based on my own experiences, especially along that stretch of the London to Brighton road, still known to our family as Tantrum Alley, the book is a serious attempt to provide all thinking adults forced to drive 2 or more small children any distance further than 10 miles with a serious alternative to opening the hatchback and dropping them on the grass verge. I begin with what can be the most significant influence in controlling the way children behave inside a car: seat belts. That is to say, as soon as they get in their seats, belt them. Should that, as it sometimes does, prove unavailing, the book then goes on to advise which of the many popular in-car children's diversions you should not allow them to go in for. Among the principal pastimes to be discouraged is the one entitled Let's See Who Can Put the Suitcase Strap Most Times Round the Hamster Before It Turns Vicious. And that equally questionable backseat diversion, Let's Count How Many Veins Appear on Daddy's Neck Every Time We Yell Police Car in His Ear. But just in case you think the book is totally devoted to things not to do, let me mention some of the positive suggestions I make for keeping children happy on a long car journey. For instance, quite an instructive little game that helps teach them both natural history and maths is the one where all the kids stand with their heads sticking up through the sunshine roof and smiling, and after 10 minutes... the one with the most insects on his teeth wins. but by far the best way of keeping them quiet on a long journey is the use of what is still probably the most effective method of easing the traditionally troubled parent-child relationship: bribery. In car travel terms, that translates itself into a process of entering into a whole series of rather shameful little treaties, such as, for example, if both of you keep your mouths absolutely shut till we pass at least 3 more signposts, when we're back home, I'll let you turn the hose on Granny again. or when we stop for something to eat, I won't say a word if you blow your orange juice straw at the waitress. Which brings me to what is perhaps the most stressful aspect of travelling en famille, the one that starts about 200 yards from your front door with the question, why didn't you go before you left? And reaches its climax as you're skidding at 70 miles an hour around some unknown corner and pleading, if you'll just keep wriggling, there's bound to be one along here somewhere. what I'm referring to, of course, is the established fact that when a car driver has small children aboard, the words stop and go do not simply refer to traffic lights.
But that problem, hitherto considered insoluble, will at last be provided with a solution with the publication of my book, because inside each copy will be a pull-out map showing the nationwide location of every public convenience, semi-public convenience, private convenience, and even large bush where a small child can make an emergency landing. Now do you see why I intend to use that line from that American song as a chapter heading? Because as soon as my book comes out, it will lend a whole new meaning to the phrase relief map. the reason being that in all sorts of hitherto unsuspected places up and down the land, parents will be leaping out of their cars, shouting joyously to the squirming little boys and girls they're dragging behind them, "Off we go into the child's loo yonder."
I can see your book being a real threat to Dr. Spock. Well, I can see from the score sheet that this week's winners are Dillis and Frank. So they have to make do with the plastic laurel leaves, while our lucky losers, Antonio and Dennis, get generous helpings of our delicious humble pie. And until we all meet again, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkin.